digitally uploaded.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Digitally Uploaded podcast. I'm Matt Sainsbury, the editor-in-chief of digitallydownloaded.net. And today with me, as usual, we have Chris.
How's it going?
And Alan.
Hey, guys.
Right, let's jump into it. Welcome back, and that was a track from Shantae. We're going to have a bit of Shantae music through the podcast today because the release of the next one is coming up nice and fast, and we're all very excited about that. So, there hasn't been too much news this week, so the segment where we talk about news is probably going to be a little bit thin. I did want to give a quick shout out to the lovely guys who have released Crossy Road, the Disney version, or Disney Crossy Road. It is great. Good to see the Aussies get in board with such a massive property. And it's a free download on various app stores for phones and whatever. It's well worth checking out. It's Crossy Road, which you've probably played by now, but it has a couple of Disney mixes thrown in there beyond the graphics. So yes, if you have a chance, go and have a look at it and get hooked all over again. But that aside, we do have a bit of news which Chris is very excited about, a physical release of a pretty niche Japanese game. Chris, take it away.
Yes, super excited. This week it was announced that the good folks at Rising Star are going to be bringing over Assault Suits Lanos for the PS4 as well as on the PC. Digital on both as well as physical on the PS4. The physical release of the PS4 is also going to include a poster as a nice little nod to everybody supporting it. For those of you guys who don't know what Assault Suits Lanos is, it's basically a giant robot version of Contra, but it's also created kind of with giant robot anime fans really in mind, because there's a very specific sense of like weightiness and recoil to the guns and the way the boosters work and the way your robot stomps around all heavy. So it's very much like a giant robot game for giant robot heads, but still full of like hectic side-scroller action. It's kind of a best of both worlds. It's really a legacy title. The game's actually a remake of the original Assault Suits Lanos, which was way back on the 16-bit Genesis. Some of you guys might actually recognize it by Target Earth, which was the name that it was given when it was brought over in English. There's actually a bunch of games in the series. This is like the sixth one. There's also Assault Suits Valken on the Super Nintendo, which was localized for English-speaking territories as Cybernator. So there's a chance that some of you old-school guys may have actually played an Assault Suits game without even knowing it yet. So it's great news. Lots of fun for old-school side-scroller fans and giant robot anime heads like yours truly.
It looks to me like, I've never played one of these games, they're really not my kind of beat, but it looks to me like it's a little bit like a kind of more free-form bullet hell kind of style of game. Is that fairly accurate, or am I completely wrong here?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of hecticness going on because it's kind of trying to mimic. There's different schools of giant robot anime, right? Like, there's giant robot animes that try to be like crazy and sci-fi and like bright colors everywhere, and then there's giant robot animes that really try to be like, this is war and war is horrible, but there just happens to be giant robots. And the Assault Suits games always have kind of tried to be that, like that hectic war, that like danger comes from everywhere. They're very unforgiving. So there is a bit of a bullet hell element, but movement isn't as free as in, say, like a bullet hell shooter, because the robots are very specifically made to have like a sense of weight and like heft to them. Like they really clunk and the screen shakes when they land from jumping and stuff. Like, if you're not aware of the weight and the capabilities of your robot, you're, like, dead right away in one of these games.
Right. I'm assuming they're difficult games.
Yeah, they're not easy. They're really challenging. But it's well in line with what's popular these days, right? Like, the more you become totally aware of what your capabilities are, the easier they get. But you can't just run in there, like, screaming and expect to beat a level. They're very tough.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess the whole difficulty thing has kind of made a comeback thanks to the Souls series. And yeah, as long as it's a fair kind of difficulty, I guess that's a-okay with me.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's not insurmountable. I mean, there's videos out there of no death runs through the whole game. You know, it's just a matter of mastery, just like all the good old side scrollers were. But this one's new and flashy, new HD graphics. It's exciting.
Sure. All right. So that kind of covers off the news. It's been a very quiet week, as we said, of interesting news. What we'll jump to, I guess, now is just quickly having a chat about what some of the games that we are playing are. I know Alan has been absolutely addicted to Enter the Gungeon.
Yep, because it's awesome and everything I could possibly want in a video game. So I'm one of those people who 100%ed Binding of Isaac and Wrath of the Lamb back in the day, and I'm still making my way through to 101% with Rebirth and Afterbirth. So Gungeon is the first game to really challenge the reign of Isaac, I guess, in the sort of more public eye. And if you've never played Isaac or Gungeon or Nuclear Throne, basically what it is, it's a top-down roguelite style game where you collect items which change how you fire, how you attack, how you defend, basic stuff like that. And then the aim is to obviously get to the end and try and win the game. As it's a roguelite, every death means that you have to restart again, which is wonderful because it means that you learn a bit more every time. It starts off a bit difficult, but then, gets easier and easier as you learn more and more about how the game works and how the mechanics work. And it's quite wonderful. I was looking at sort of the amount of items that are in Enter the Gungeon, and it is huge, and everything that I've sort of played with so far has been completely different to any other item in the game, which is quite impressive, really, when you consider the amount of things that are in the game to begin with. There are a lot of characters. The enemies are adorable. I want a plush of the bullet enemy so badly. And yeah, it's going to scratch that itch quite well, I reckon, for anyone who's a fan of the older roguelite-styled games. I think it's $22 for Australians at the moment, and it's $15 over in the US, so I very much would recommend picking up if you want sort of like a difficult roguelite-styled game. Also does have co-op. That's a really cool feature. I quite like that. I've been playing like a bit with some friends of mine. I really would recommend it to pretty much everyone if you like that sort of game, because I know that Matt isn't a particular fan of Binding of Isaac, so I don't know if I can really quite honestly say he'll enjoy it, but, you know, just go from there.
My question about Gungeon, I'm really intrigued by it too. I mean, first of all, it's beautiful. Like, if you're a pixel art freak like I am, it's just the aesthetic is unreal. Really cool, really top-notch pixel art. My question for you, since you've played it and I have not, but very much would like to, is there any system of like static progression? I mean, it's kind of become fashionable in the roguelike games these days to obviously have the permanent death and the restarts every time, but then like little gains in between. Like, I really liked how Rogue Legacy had you gaining permanent power in between every round, which then mixed up how you began in the next round. I really like those kind of elements in my roguelike games.
Yeah, so there is a system where you get these things called hegemony credits, I think.
Okay.
And they're given out after every boss fight. You usually get one or two if it's on the sort of earlier floors, and then you can get 2 to 3 on sort of floor 3 up. I've not made it past 4 yet, so it's a bit... I can't really speak for later on in the game. But, you get these credits, and then you can go to a shop in like the sort of lobby area of the game to buy access to new guns that'll then appear in the Gungeon.
Okay.
So you can get like an... It'll have like a... RPG or something, and if you buy the RPG will now appear in the Gungeon, which...
Okay.
Yeah.
So there is some permanent progress.
Yeah.
That's nice, because I'm not fond of like pure roguelikes, where there's no sense of permanent progression between runs.
Yeah, this actually does respect your time, so you're not going to be crying after losing a run or anything, because there is always something you can get.
I mean, I quite liked Binding of Isaac, but that was something that turned me off with Isaac, was I didn't like the lack of permanent progression. So that's exciting to hear that Gungeon kind of solves that problem for me and wraps it up in an aesthetic that I find absolutely delightful. Thank you.
Yeah, it's absolutely wonderful. I, like I said, would recommend it to pretty much everyone. It's very, very good, and I'm going to spend a lot of time on it. And I believe that Matt actually wants to talk about something as well that's quite near and dear to his heart. Chris, do you want to take a guess what that might be? Just before Matt says anything, what do you reckon it might be?
It's not Wild Arms.
It's never Wild Arms.
Hey, I'd be all for it, Wild Arms. Mind you, Wild Arms isn't exactly Hatsune Miku, so...
there we go.
Yeah. No, I've been playing Hatsune Miku like crazy since my import copy of Project Diva X arrived last week. When I say like crazy, I really do mean like crazy. I think my time clock's up to like something like 30 hours already. And I just published my review yesterday of it. It's basically the longest review I've ever written. It's about 3,600 words or thereabouts, and basically it's a great long love letter to the game and Hatsune Miku, so go and read it, because I put a lot of work into it. So in terms of what it is, I mean, people should probably know that Hatsune Miku is a rhythm game by now, but it comes to us from Sega, who is basically the master of the genre, and it's probably the most refined, I guess, series of rhythm games that they've produced over the years. They've got it. they've got the formula down to a kind of a really nice pattern now, and the gameplay itself is just kind of very rock solid. So between Hatsune Miku Games, what you're looking for now is really just new track lists and new music to play around with, new costumes for the characters, and all of that kind of thing. And this game certainly delivers on those fronts. It's got the best track set, I think, of the Hatsune Miku games that I've played to date. And there's something like 300-odd different costumes for the various characters that you can unlock, which I still haven't done yet. So that gives you an idea of just how much gameplay's in there if you want to collect everything. But yeah, if you're into rhythm games and you haven't played a Hatsune Miku game yet, you kind of are missing out. You owe it to yourself to play one, and I demand you do.
Same question I posed to Alan about Gungeon, reskinned for Miku. Do I recall correctly reading that X, the new Miku, is supposed to have some kind of like RPG-light like progression like mode in it too, or is that another one that's coming out soon?
Yeah, don't get me started on that. Okay, so I guess the one criticism I do have of the game, which I kind of do explore in my review, is that it does have a story mode. And the reason that I say that, despite being a guy that kind of cheers whenever a narrative's put in anything, is with Hatsune Miku, I guess the appeal of the character, the appeal of the entire Hatsune Miku IP franchise beyond the games, the entire thing, is that Miku's basically a kind of blank canvas. So what Krypton did in the original stages was just give her a voice, give her a character design, and then say, you know, go with it. All of the Miku stuff's kind of under Creative Commons license, so people can basically play around with it as they want, and they did. And the whole reason that Miku is as popular as she is now is because everything is fan-driven. So all the costumes are designed by fans, all the music is basically written by fans, even the commercial stuff is just basically by producers who picked up the software and kind of really got on board with it all. So everything's driven by fans, and when you then go and put a story into it, you start dictating to people what the Miku character is, and I think that's kind of contrary to what Krypton wanted from Hatsune Miku, if that makes sense.
Yeah, very much so. It's not a good fit for the property. It's just not a...
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you were to put story mode in basically anything else, then I'd be all for it, because I do think story gives context even to arcade games, and even when it's a very thin story, at least it gives you something to kind of latch onto. But in the with the Hatsune Miku games in particular, you're always going to want to create your own character around these characters. It's a bit like Link from the Legend of Zelda series. I mean, the great thing about what Nintendo's done with Link is they've never given him a voice, they've never given him dialogue. He kind of just grunts and groans. And that's because Nintendo wants you to put your own character spin onto Link, and then it becomes your adventure. So in the same sense, I kind of don't want people giving me a Hatsune Miku character. I want to create my own character around her. I've got my own ideas about what she is.
Sure.
And yeah, so let's hope Sega never does that again. That's an experiment. I think it's going to be fairly controversial in the Miku community, especially once it comes out west. And hopefully they got that out of the system.
Yeah, it's curious. It's because one of the things, you know, that never really appealed to me about Miku was kind of the lack of that. Like, I'm not a huge rhythm game guy by any means, but like when I think about like my favorite rhythm games, like the original Parappa, Guitaru Man, they've all had like a light narrative. So like, it wasn't just about experimenting with the tracks, but it was also about like moving your way through a story via music. But it sounds like that's just not right for what Miku means. So it's a shame that doesn't work out well.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm absolutely not against story modes being in rhythm games. Like, a good example of that is the Taiko game from Japan, the drum. You know, everyone knows the drum.
Sure,
right?
Yeah, Taiko's great.
Yeah, so on the Vita, he has a full RPG mode with, you know, items to collect and boss battles and all of that kind of stuff. And it is good. I really enjoyed it in that context because Taiko isn't a blank slate. He's not designed as a canvas. He's designed as a specific character with a specific personality from the start. But again, I mean, what Miku is to me is not what she is to somebody else. And then... We've got Sega kind of saying, well, no, you're all wrong. This is what Miku actually is. And I don't think that sits particularly well with the character. And it's disappointing because Sega's always, to date, Sega's always been exactly in lockstep with what Krypton's vision for Miku has been. Like, the Hatsune Miku games are really just kind of collaborative efforts with all the community. So all the music comes from the fans. The costumes are basically the fan design costumes. So it's just disappointing to see Sega misfire on its understanding of the property in this case.
Oh, in a sense, though, couldn't you frame it as kind of Sega doing that? Like, if Krypton is the owner of the Miku like brand, this is Sega's take on what Miku is. This is their fan take on who she might be from Sega's perspective. I don't know. I'm just trying to contextualize it in a way that makes it suck less.
And it doesn't suck at all. Like, you can skip past all the dialogue in the game anyway, which I've just done since kind of testing it out for the review. You can skip past all that narrative stuff, and then you don't need to worry about what Sega's vision of Miku is. I guess, I mean, on one level, you're kind of right. I completely agree that, you know, Sega, being a fan itself, kind of has every right to create its own character around Miku. I guess my complaint about that is just simply like a personal subjective one. It's just I don't like it.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, there's a lot of me's that are going to be out there.
I'm just playing devil's advocate, you know.
No, absolutely. I guess it's a complex thing to kind of think about. I've thought about, you know, the character of Miku a lot. And what she means, and what she should be. And I think the problem is that Sega is like a gatekeeper to the character as part of the official, you know, has the official partnership with Krypton and has a responsibility for taking Miku out to the masses. I think they need to be in line with Krypton's vision for the character itself. And I'd be interested. If I had a chance, I'd love to actually ask the guys at Krypton what they think about, you know, sticking story modes into Sega, into the Miku games. I'm not sure they'd be on board with it entirely themselves. So
I'd be surprised if they didn't have some kind of right of approval.
Yeah, it's typical Japanese companies. They're not very open about how they do their business with one another. So I'm not sure exactly the relationship between Sega and Krypton. But yeah, it would be interesting to see their thoughts. And if they did greenlight it, why they did greenlight a story mode, is that a sign that they're going to start sticking the character in some personality into Miku? It's going to be interesting to see. All right, so that's me ranting on about Miku for probably far too long. We will go to some music, give you all a chance to recover from that, and we'll come back and talk about something a little bit different. And welcome back. That was a track from Knights of Azure. I've said it the last couple of weeks, but yeah, play it. It's good. It's really good. Okay, so let's talk about Miitomo, Nintendo's first mobile phone application. It was released last week. We've all been playing around with it a little bit, and we've got our views on it. I guess I'll start. Not the biggest fan of it, as it turns out. I mean, I still use it. I like it in the sense that it's, you know, something fun to do while I'm walking to work or on the train. But I guess I find some issues with just how narcissistic it all is. So basically with Miitomo, what you do is you kind of sit there and you ask, the application asks you questions, which you answer. Those answers are kind of sent out to your social group that you pull in from Facebook, Twitter, and so on. And that's basically the entirety of the app. You can also dress your character up with various weird and wonderful costumes, and you get you pay for those using coins, coins that you earn by asking and reading other people's answers and responding to those. So it's a very limited application. It's designed to be just this kind of very easy social interaction, and I guess in an odd way to kind of get to know your social networks a bit better by having them kind of ask and answer questions. But I find it all very, very narcissistic, as I said. I mean, the whole point of it is to kind of just answer questions. And there's a certain, once you get over the thrill of being able to dress your me up with all these weird costumes and start kind of talking about how great you are and how funny you are with answering answering these questions, you kind of start to realize, well, you know, I don't think people really care about my answers to these questions. And you know, am I really that important that, you know, an entire application needs to be built around my thoughts on random topics? So those are kind of my top line thoughts about Miitomo. I'll probably keep using it. I've noticed that already the actual community interactions has dropped down quite significantly. Like the first couple of days, as you can probably expect, you know, everybody's jumping on board with it. Everybody's just going crazy with answering the questions and, you know, leaving comments on each other's answers. That's kind of died down quite a bit. I've got about 50 people that I've made friends with through this thing, and yeah, I'm down to only needing kind of check it once per day for, you know, 15 minutes to kind of keep up with everything. So yeah, I don't know if it's going to be the success that Nintendo wanted it to be either. We all probably saw the news that it was downloaded 3 million times or something within the first couple of days of launch. The thing with that is, while that's an impressive number, if you have a look at what where Miitomo sat on the revenue rankings on the App Store and whatever, it's not even broken into the top 150. It's not even on the charts at all. So that kind of tells me that while it's been downloaded a lot of times, absolutely no one's actually putting money into it, which means they got the monetization model wrong. And I don't see this thing having a very long future, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it just sort of strikes me as a Tomodachi Life, but with less interaction. And I already didn't like Tomodachi Life because I thought it was very just bleh. But Miitomo, I just couldn't get into it. I've turned it on like twice, and then I uninstalled it because I just wasn't interested in anything that was happening in the entire experience. Because I'm not really going to call that a game; it's an app. It's got no real sense of what a game, I guess, is. It's more just like a bizarre social media platform that Nintendo's tried to make, I guess. And I don't really find it all that interesting, to be honest.
Well, in fairness, I don't think Nintendo ever intended on it being a game. I think it was quite clearly an application from the start. I don't think Nintendo's referred to it a game once, so yeah, I don't think we should be judging it within the context of the game. I think we should be judging it in the context as a social media application.
And it's not very good in that aspect either, in my opinion. So,
well, yeah, it kind of takes the worst parts of Facebook or Twitter in the sense that you're kind of broadcasting, you know, your own nonsense out to the world, and then streamlines it to the point where it doesn't add much value to the social interactions. So at least with Facebook and Twitter, when I'm kind of, you know, going on my little rants, people can respond to those, and then you can have a discussion, and it's not kind of restricted in any way. But with Miitomo, there's no real room to have those kinds of interactions. And I know Nintendo probably did that in order to make sure that the community that builds around it isn't quite so toxic, and congratulations to them for doing that. It's not a very toxic community at all. It's just not. I just don't get value out of my time on it. It's very unengaging in that way.
Hmm. Yeah.
I think.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was gonna say, I think with Miitomo too, just like anything in the social networking and like casual mobile game sphere, it's tough for guys like the three of us who are A, highly intelligent and highly critical and into games and into tech to criticize it and evaluate it, because we might not necessarily be the target audience for it. Like, you know, we recognize the inherent narcissism and pointlessness in social networking, so of course it's not going to appeal to us. But, like, I got my wife into it, and she's already mad at me because I don't use it as much as I did on launch day anymore. But she's still having fun with it. My little sister has a load of fun with it. So I don't see myself using it much in the future, but there's definitely certain demographics who are still going to keep using it just because it's cute and cheeky. They're not the people who take the time to examine the monetization models and stuff like that. You know, there's definitely people out there who are going to get value out of it, potentially lasting value, if Nintendo keeps providing content for it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I do think you're completely right there. I think there are probably demographics for it. I find it interesting that Nintendo chose for that to be its first mobile venture, because to me it just doesn't represent that Nintendo necessarily understands the mobile space quite as well as it needs to. And I think that's kind of playing out by the fact that it isn't being monetized very well. Whether that was Nintendo's intention to kind of release this almost as a loss leader just to get people on board with the idea that Nintendo is on mobile platforms, I don't know. I'll be interested to see what comes next for them on the mobile applications and see if it's monetized better, because I think that's pretty important.
I think it's also worth examining to remember that Miitomo doesn't exist kind of in this vacuum. Like, yes, it is Nintendo's first mobile app, but it's also a companion application to the new My Nintendo account system. Mm. Like they're linked. So, like, in and of itself, Miitomo doesn't have a lot of value, but then when you link it to the My Nintendo account, which is going to have some kind of lasting value, just like the old Club Nintendo did, suddenly there's this cross-functionality. So, I mean, I think there's room, like, potential, I don't know, for it to grow or become something that's far, far more than it is now, depending on how the My Nintendo account matures into something in the community as well. I'm just trying to be as optimistic as possible.
And I think there is potential there, definitely there is. Nintendo is building a social network in what it's doing. And I guess it just depends. I mean, there's going to be plenty of opportunities for Nintendo to link Miitomo into its other games and applications, like you say, through that My Nintendo account. So there's every chance that they can continue to update it and develop it and improve it, just as they did with Miiverse. And Miiverse has turned out to be, you know, within its demographic, quite a useful little feature as well. Welcome back again. So that was another track from Shantae. As you can tell, the music in that game series is just divine, so we can't wait to see what they come up with next. Okay, so for the last segment this week, we thought we'd have a chat about a topic that I think pretty much everyone's spoken about at some stage or another, games that they've specifically spent a lot of time playing. Everybody has their kind of favorite games that they can kind of keep playing over and over again, and given that pretty much all the games these days actually track how long you've been playing, it's both easy and kind of scary to track just how long you've spent with some of your favorite games. So I will open the floor to Alan. And Alan, what game have you spent an awful lot of time playing, and why do you think you've spent so much time playing it?
So I used to be really heavily into online shooters. I still am, but much, much less than I used to be because of uni commitments and other things like that. But I used to be really involved with the competitive Team Fortress 2 scene in Australia. And that basically meant that I would be spending a lot of time practicing Team Fortress 2 with my team all the time for, you know, like an hour a day sort of thing. Which probably didn't help out my grades or anything, but I enjoyed it and I got pretty good at it, I like to think. I have spent over, I think, 1,500 hours on Team Fortress 2, which is pretty substantial, I'd say. And it's entirely due to just this competitive scene, which I adore and still love to watch, and Overwatch is probably going to become the next thing I'm going to get really heavily into, which is scary because I don't know if I have the time to get that into it. Yeah, it's interesting. I'm very, very excited to see how that game can control my life like Team Fortress 2 did.
Hopefully it'll be as successful.
Yeah, I hope so. It looks like it should. I mean, it's got the same amount of personality, because I think the reason that TF2 succeeded so well was because it had a personality alongside the shooter gameplay. Like watching
there's a reason.
There's a reason that Valve knows what they're doing, and it's because of things like that. Like, even when the Meet the Heavy came out, like people started playing the Heavy completely differently. And when this Meet the Soldier came out, people started playing the Soldier differently, and it was so bizarre, and it's like, I think Overwatch is really tapping into that so far with the Pixar-esque animations that they've got going. I'm very excited for that.
There are a few online competitive shooters I own. Team Fortress 2 is one of them. Because yeah. it's based on openness and a pure sense of fun and charming art direction and character design. There's very few negative things I can say about Team Fortress 2. I mean, I have a physical copy. Like, before it went free to play, I'm very proud of that.
I also do. Because what happened was, when I was living in Adelaide, we didn't have internet to really download games. So in about 2009, I managed to source a copy of the Orange Box on PC. Installed Team Fortress 2 only to discover that it was like another 5 gigs of updates, which was about a quarter of my internet allowance for the month. So yeah, I mean, if I could put in over 1,000 hours on like 25 gigs a month of internet allowance, I reckon that game probably did something right. But Chris, what did you spend most time on? I'm actually quite interested to know this. Because it's probably JRPG that I have no idea about and you need to play.
It's not a tradition. It's not traditional JRPG stuff, actually. I love Wild Arms, but I kind of just play them and beat them. Like, I don't really go back and revisit RPG. I don't really go back and revisit traditional RPGs very often. Once I've beaten them once, there's too many other ones I want to play next. But the games probably I spend the most time on are kind of games with really endless feedback loops. Like, I really like Monster Hunter, and I really like Phantasy Star Online. So, the original Phantasy Star Online. If we're talking about franchises, easily Monster Hunter across the series, going all the way back to the PS2, I've spent the most time in. Individual games, it would be the original GameCube version of Phantasy Star Online. I probably put 700-800 hours into that. For me, I have to get sucked into these satisfying feedback loops, because what really gets me into a game, and this is true of any genre, above narrative, above gameplay, is the art direction and design and just wanting to see what's next. So when you get these games with like a loot loop, like Monster Hunter and Phantasy Star or Diablo, like just the very drive to see what the next cool piece of armor is and what the next cool weapon is or the next variation on a boss is, to see those art resources alone can suck me into like multi-hundred hour commitments. Like that's what gets me going real, real hard. I love this whole like action hunting genre that's spawned off of Monster Hunter for that same reason. Loved Tokiden, loved Ragnarok Odyssey, very much looking forward to the new God Eater. Just all these gear collecting focused games just suck me in for hours and hours and hours.
Well, on that topic actually, what did you think of Freedom Wars?
I actually didn't play Freedom Wars.
Okay.
Mainly because I'm kind of... You guys know by now how much I love to collect games, physical, and all these hunting games usually come out and have like the G version with like the expansions. So I didn't buy Freedom Wars because I was going to wait for the expanded one, and that never came, and I never hopped on with it.
It was on PS Plus, I think, for a while as well. That's how I play.
I don't have PS Plus.
It's a worthwhile system because it means I can get relatively cheap games. I'm not paid by Sony, I promise.
Just jumping in there, I have played Freedom Wars thanks to PS Plus. It's just something I've been playing on the background for the last couple of weeks, I guess, since it landed on Plus. I really, really like it. I'm kind of semi on board with these monster games for the most part. The thing that's always kind of put me off them ever so slightly is, I guess, the relatively safe narratives that they run with. I know narrative's not the focus of them, but yeah, they don't tend to have the kind of in-depth narrative that I'm looking for, especially in collaboration with those really kind of gorgeous art direction that they all kind of gun for. I always want that extra bit of context. But Freedom Wars certainly has that extra, I guess, narrative theme that I really kind of get on board with. It's really quite dark and cold. Very, dystopian in nature. And, you know, if I can apply the word dystopia to a game, then I'm pretty much going to be in love with it by default. I find those narratives good explanations of the human condition and so on and so forth without giving you the essay version of it. Freedom Wars is definitely an example of how... the monster genre can kind of be applied to the monster monster hunting genre. We've only really kind of seen semi-decent attempts at that before with the likes of Soul Sacrifice. I think Freedom Wars is probably the first example that really achieved that.
Oh, I was just going to say, certainly I had not playing Freedom Wars isn't for lack of wanting to. Like I said, it was just because I was hoping there would be an updated version with more content down the line. But I just wanted to drop for you philosophy fans out there, if there's any of you listening, that there's some Foucault references in Freedom Wars because it's based on the idea of the Panopticon, which is one of Michel Foucault's most famous theories. So I'm sure it's quite a philosophically dense game to unpack when you work through that narrative.
It absolutely is. I mean, I rarely say that people should probably study philosophy before playing a game because that's probably not something they're going to do. But in this case, I really would recommend that people do kind of get across Foucault's understanding or theory of the Panopticon in order to understand what Freedom Wars is about because... Yeah, it does help. It does help understand what the narrative is kind of driving at.
I didn't really enjoy Freedom Wars, actually, just personally myself, because it just didn't control well for me. And maybe that's because I have very like lanky hands and the Vita is not particularly easy to hold. But I found that it just felt very lethargic, I guess. Like everything had a bit of delay.
From a gameplay point of view, it certainly had its weaknesses. But then I could say the same about just about every monster game, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I struggle incredibly to take down even the kind of the lowest level monsters in Monster Hunter. So, you know, not a genre for controls, as far as I'm concerned.
Having said that, though, when Monster Hunter Tri came out, I remember my brother-in-law and I getting very excited about it, and we pre-ordered the special edition, which came with the amazing, I think it was the black and gold controller, Wii controller.
Yeah, the pro controller.
Yeah, it was super, super comfortable to use. We had no idea what the hell Monster Hunter was. So we went we went into it and just immediately ate shit and died. And we're like, this isn't fun. So we never played it again.
Yeah, I mean, people want to get sassy about Dark Souls. Go play some Monster Hunter. Go play some G level 10, you know, high star missions where like three Godzillas are chasing you and all you have is a sword and a shield. Monster Hunter got that challenge factor.
Because we went into the arena mode because we were like, yeah, let's play the co-op mode. It'll be exciting. We're gonna kill monsters. Yeah, and then just immediately, it just died. So much, and it was one of those things where it was like, are we doing this wrong? Nah, game's bad. Just like left.
Well, speaking of difficulty, I will kind of mention again Hatsune Miku. I get to keep talking about Miku this week, and it's great. I do love that. So yeah, if we want to talk about Dark Souls of / genre, the Miku games is certainly that in the rhythm game genre.
Can we not do this Dark Souls of X, please? We look like a clickbait. Because it's the Dark Souls of Dark Souls.
I just do it to be ironic anymore because it's so stupid. I was going to call Assault Suit Leinos the Dark Souls of giant robot side-scrollers, but then I realized that the property's 20 years old and it would have been ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, it's silly. I do it as a joke as well. But point being that the Hatsune Miku games are difficult enough that I would have spent across, how many is it now? 1, 2, 3, 4, this is my 5th Miku game now. I would have been over 1,000 hours easily, possibly pushing 1,200 now. Anyway, point is, I play them a lot, and keep playing them. Because they are, they're a huge challenge. People kind of play them on easy and then normal mode and then review them and think that that's done. But once you kind of get into the hard and difficult modes, hard and extreme modes, just clearing them becomes a challenge. And that's before you even get to the next stage, which is where, you know, once you get to become a hardcore Miku player, you need to kind of go. The next challenge is to get perfect runs where you don't actually make a mistake at any point in the timing through the entire track. And once you get past that, the next step is to kind of start setting yourself some little personal challenges, like, I don't know, doing them blindfolded and so on, which I have done, by the way. I can get a perfect blindfolded with a couple of tracks. I guess the Miku games don't have that much content in them in the sense that they don't have thousands of hours worth of content in them. That's not the point. They do have a lot. They'll last you a long time if you buy them and don't kind of go obsessive over them. But you know, the thing that's great about them is they do continue to add additional levels, layers of challenge, and they open the door to create your own kind of challenges as you go on. And I think to me, that's kind of an example of a game that's worth sticking a lot of time into. They don't come across very often. So, Miku, good.
Yeah, I think I never got invested in Miku because I'm not a score chaser. Like, that's never something that appealed to me. Like, people always assume I'm a score chaser because I really like vertical shmups, like bullet hell games, but I don't play them for the score. I play them for the art direction. Like, I like to see the next set of enemies and the next bullet pattern. Like, my like of those games is totally unrelated to why most people like them. So,
well, I mean, if you're talking about art direction, I mean, Miku is the cutest thing ever, so that should certainly count. but yeah, I guess with regards to score attacks, I never actually really notice the score I get in a Miku game, mostly because I'm aiming for like an absolutely perfect score. So it's not so much the score that's the challenge, I think, in these games. It's more about that actual perfection run. And they're just
ratings. You know, I mean ratings too when I say score chaser. Like, I'm not the kind of guy who plays a game to get like A's, B's, or perfects. Like, I just, it's not just not a focus for me.
And that, yeah, of course, that's fair enough. It's just, I guess that's when you look at the rhythm games, the rhythm game genre in isolation, if it doesn't have that ability to hook you in where you do want to get perfects, then it's probably not a great rhythm game.
Oh, absolutely. That's why it's not a favorite genre of mine.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's just a trait that the genre has to be able to meet.
Absolutely.
I would argue that Miku does it probably better than any. Maybe Guitar Hero gets close if you're into nonsense rock music.
I was going to mention that. I think the reason I'm not really into Miku, but I got so into Guitar Hero, was because I don't appreciate the music as much. And having said that, no, I can't actually play any Guitar Hero game because as a guitarist, I'm terrible at Guitar Hero. Because I'm not sure there's any single person in the world who can play actual guitar and play Guitar Hero without being terrible at one or the other. I'm not sure it exists. I got really, really into Guitar Hero back in the day. I even bought the DS one.
That was really cool. That accessory was cool.
Yeah, but it was like the claw of death. It would give you actual like finger strain. It was so bad. They didn't design it at all for human beings.
I just talked about Monster Hunter, so I know a thing or two about getting the Claw of Death. Isn't that the game's, like, notorious?
Any game on the 3DS that just tries to... It uses the weird circle pad thing when you don't have the extra, like, add-on circle pad. It's just a nightmare to control and hold. But I need to probably check out Miku at some point because Matt doesn't stop talking about it, and I feel like that's probably... Probably a sign that they're not the worst games in the world.
I really like the 3DS one. Like, that felt like a really good entry point if you're not, like, huge into the whole Miku thing. Like, that one felt really accessible to me. The PS3 ones felt less accessible to me coming from the outside.
I agree with you completely. Like, Mirai, which is the 3DS one, is it basically was designed as, I guess, the entry into Miku for people. It adopts a much more, I guess, general sense of cute through the art style that pretty much everyone can be on board with, as opposed to, I guess, the more realistic, and I put that in inverted commas, anime style of the PS3 and Vita ones. And then the gameplay itself is definitely more streamlined and more accessible for people, especially for younger people that might struggle to press the buttons as quickly as they can, as they need to be. So the touchscreen is definitely the way to go if you want to kind of get into Miku for the first time. So, yeah, I agree that Mirai is probably... It was a good experiment in bringing Miku to a broader audience.
Yeah, like if I bought a Miku game, it would be that one. It would be Mirai, because the visuals on that are ridiculously awesome.
Just so cute.
Yeah, it's unbearable how cute it is. It's unreal. It's so good.
Is it better than Persona 4 Dancing All Night?
As a rhythm game?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, much better.
Much better? Wow, okay. Yeah, I'll pick it up then.
I mean, I really like Persona 4 Dancing All Night, but I haven't put anywhere near as much time into Persona 4 Dancing All Night because once you work through the story mode and kind of get sick of taking screenshots of Reset, you kind of haven't got too much left. I mean, the rhythm game is good. It works, but, yeah, there's not as many tracks. It's easier, I guess, to get good scores with them. It kind of finishes over fairly quickly. Whereas with the Miku games, they just keep going, and they just keep adding layers of challenge, and you've got many more costumes to play around with, so you can take many more screenshots and spend time with that. That side of things is much stronger.
Okay.
Obviously, of course, the music is going to be a big determining factor too, and the Persona 4 music's probably, I guess, more appealing to more people. I imagine that you would be one of those people, Alan. You know,
It has the Juness theme. The Juness theme is the best thing in the world. What was that for?
That was I love the Juness theme. Listen, I've gone on record as saying I'm not a huge fan of Persona. That does not carry over to the Persona soundtracks.
Yes.
Persona soundtracks are easily some of the most divine soundtracks in all of the industry. I will buy 5 just for the music, even if I don't plan on playing it that much. Like, love the music in the Persona games.
Mm.
I will say one thing just to wrap up, though. I mean, with the one thing that really confused me about Persona 4 Dancing All Night's soundtrack was it was all these remixes of all these great Persona 4 songs, and got no issues with any of the tracks that were on there. But the for a game that was like specifically about Reset and continuing her story, to not actually have a remix of her theme song was a bit weird, and I don't know why. And I think that was a waste opportunity. Maybe for a sequel. A PS4, Persona 4 Dancing All Night would be good.
I didn't play that game, but it all seemed pretty slapdash to me.
The dancing choreography is actually really good, though. Like they did,
it was
they
a really high quality... Yeah.
They put a lot of work into that game. It was
really did. It was actually... I think everybody kind of thought, oh, this is a little bit, you know, kind of nonsense when it was first announced. But, yeah, they really did go all out with it to come up with a different rhythm system to what we'd seen before. I don't think there's another rhythm game that uses that exact mechanics. The music, the remixes, the effort that went into getting all these remixes together is just amazing. And yeah, the actual art direction is just it's one of the best looking PS Vita games as far as I'm concerned.
Definitely.
All right, so that wraps up our spirited conversation this week. Thank you very much for listening, as always, everyone. You'll be able to catch us on our social medias and through the Podbean application. And if you subscribe, it will automatically download each week. So do that, and that way you won't miss a single word that we have to say. So, yeah, thank you very much for your time, and we will see you next week.
Catch you guys.
See ya.
Digitally uploaded.